Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. Today, we're diving into the latest developments regarding NACHA's new rules aimed at combating credit push fraud. Joining me is Mike Hurd, Executive Vice President of ACH Network Administration at NACHA, and Brian Riley, Director of Credit and Co-Head of Payments at Javelin Strategy and Research. They're going to explore the implications of these regulations and discuss who will be affected by them and how these new rules will ensure that ACH network participants are informed and prepared for their implementation. Mike, let's start with the news that NACHA just passed new rules to address credit push fraud. What are the new rules and why are NACHA members addressing this issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. The NACHA membership began this journey late in 2022 with the publication of a new risk management strategy that identified frauds that result from things like business email compromise or vendor impersonations that result in payments being pushed out from the account of the victim or the payer, if you will, to the account of the fraudster. So a credit push type payment. So this was an expansion of focus for us from perspective of ACH risk management. And we identified as some objectives the desire to reduce the successful incidence of those types of frauds and also to improve the ability for recovery when those types of frauds and those payments have occurred. And so that led us into our rulemaking process in the summer of 2023. And as the news shows, our membership just approved those set of rules recently. At their core, the new rules raise the bar for fraud monitoring and transaction monitoring across all ACH participants, except consumers. They also create new means of recovery in the event that a fraud was successful. So ultimately, we're taking the position that everyone has a role to play in fraud mitigation and detection and recovery, that all parties have kind of a basic level requirement to monitor transactions, and that honestly, it would no longer be acceptable to do nothing, right? So doing nothing about fraud detection and mitigation is no longer going to be permissible.
Well, this is one of those big deal issues, Mike, as I see it, because on credit push fraud, you're dealing with what the FBI has said is probably the second most important fraud vulnerability that exists for consumer complaints. So that's a big deal when you think about it. You're dealing with people's paychecks, right? And Joe Sixpack needs his paycheck tomorrow and cannot afford to just wait, oh, oops, there's a technology blip here and I don't have money in my account. I've got to do things like pay for my kids' school and pay for lunches and pay for the basics. So ignoring this is really
Yeah, Brian, I think to that point, you know, part of what we're encompassing here is what we call like a payroll impersonation fraud, where a Joe Sixpack, to use your term, might have been spoofed into providing, you know, their payroll portal credentials to a fraudster, and their pay by direct deposit gets rerouted to a fraudster's account. That certainly is within scope for the types of fraud scenarios we're trying to address, in which hopefully some higher levels of transaction monitoring will be effective in addressing.
Sure. And it could be Jane Sixpack too, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So to expand on that a bit more, who really is going to be impacted by these new rules and when will they go into effect?
Well, to some extent, all financial institutions and ACH processors will be impacted. So the rules are pretty broad-based. But many of those organizations already conduct fairly robust fraud monitoring, so the impact to them might be minimal. But there could be others that are not doing much today, and they will have a bigger lift in order to become compliant with these rules. I think one of the things that is unique here with this rule set is that for the first time, we are defining a role for the receiving financial institutions with respect to transaction monitoring. You know, under the existing framework, I think both on the ACH and maybe elsewhere, you know, the receiving institutions are fairly passive and their obligations are to post transactions on a timely basis and make funds available to the account holder. So while these rules don't shift any liabilities for transactions, we are seeing that receiving institutions will have requirements for transaction monitoring. And there may be some receiving institutions out there in the world that really aren't looking at that today and may have additional work to do. going back to Brian's example about the, you know, the payroll direct deposit, a receiving institution might be in the best position to see that payroll transactions coming in look irregular, that they're getting received into a account that looks like a mule account, or that somebody that was getting a regular payroll deposit is no longer getting a payroll deposit. So it's those kinds of irregularities that can potentially be red flags to follow up on. I should point out that one of these rules is actually going to create a standard description for payroll transactions to make that kind of monitoring more feasible for the receiving institution. So that's really what we're getting at. From the perspective of when does it all go into effect, we have a number of effective dates for various pieces that will start in October 1st of this year, October 1st, 2024, and continue all the way through mid-2026, when some of the more significant types of fraud monitoring and transaction monitoring requirements across all the parties in the network finally take effect. I would say no one has to wait that long. They could start, if they're not already doing it, they could start doing the things that are contemplated by these rules tomorrow or as soon as they are ready. As soon as they're ready to go live, they don't have to wait till the last minute. But that is kind of like the deadline for when things have to be done.
What you said about the indicator makes a lot of sense, right? And it looks like a way that it can be practically done on both sides.
Right.
But now the responsibility you're talking about is on the receiving end. What about on the originating end? Are there any?
Yeah, so there will be obligations on both sides of the transaction to do transaction monitoring. So we're following the flow of a payment from origination through the sending institution and then through to the receiving institution at the point of the receipt at the account. So it is intended to follow the flow of the transaction and that we would have all the parties to that performing some level of transaction monitoring.
And that really makes this a lot of sense in the context of you need to think of faster payments all around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't get that entry point,
mm-hmm.
then that account can be depleted really quickly, right? So time is really of the essence in capturing this, I would think.
Time is definitely of the essence when you're talking about this type of fraud monitoring, detection, and recovery as well. You know, when a payment, a credit push type payment gets to a receiving account and the funds are made available in the receiving account, the fraudsters are going to try to move that money out and move it elsewhere as quickly as they can. And so time truly is of the essence when you're talking about detection and recovery.
Makes sense.
Mike, you spoke about these new rules, who they're going to impact, but I'm sure they're also going to impact the ACH network once implemented. Can you speak to that and how, you know, they're also going to help reduce fraud, as you previously mentioned?
Yes. So NACHA and our members are always cognizant of and working to maintain and improve the safety and soundness of the ACH network as a payment system, that it's, you know, safe and reliable and that parties can use it. And I think this just kind of contributes to that, you know, overall perspective and overall effort to keep the ACH, you know, safe and sound. I think one of the things I try to call out about this effort is it's really not the payments that are the fraud, right? The fraud happens when an organization, a business, the treasury office is victimized, when they're fished and spoofed or socially engineered to do something. And, you know, the payments are flowing as intended, right? And elsewhere, I've heard them called authorized payments fraud or authorized push payments fraud, right? The payments themselves are typically authorized. The treasury or the payroll function has approved them and wants them to be issued. So from the perspective of the payment network, they look like any other type of authorized payment. Nevertheless, you know, we think there is opportunity here to raise the bar, to try to help identify these instances and to try to help recovery. So, you know, I think, you know, sending organizations like corporate treasuries, like payroll offices, like the processors, you know, they have a role as well. They should have best practices in place to not be victimized by these types of scams.
So where this all fits into the process flow, you're talking about the sending, or the sender, if you will,
mm-hmm.
processing through to the receiver with this encoded transaction indicator that says this is a payroll. Now, if going back to Jane or Joe Sixpack, they theoretically have direct deposits set up for their rent, and there, you know, might be other things that go in on that. There's going to be a period here within a blind spot that I see on this, right, between where the fraud occurs and when it should have loaded into their account, and potentially having cascading NSF fees going on that customer if this fails. So has the consumer protected on this?
So Brian, let's start off by saying that no detection and prevention system is 100% effective, right? It's not today. It won't be when these new rules go into effect. But we've identified the need and have the rules passed to get better at it. And I think from you know, kind of the perspective I just shared before, let's say you're the payroll office, you know, you have some obligations as well to be able to validate changes within a payroll system, right? Should you just take anybody's word that payroll should now go somewhere different? There should be some type of validation of that change order for the payroll. And the same is true with vendor payments, or the classic, you know, the CEO is saying issue an emergency wire transfer somewhere, right? I think the culture has to be suspicious of those, and that they require validation and verification through different channels. So I think there's always going to be that need to have an obligation on the sending party, what we call the originator in the ACH world, to self-help. Nevertheless, I think there's also roles for other parties in the transaction chain. Their bank that they process through might be able to detect that kind of change. Or on the receiving end, when a payment comes into an account, they might be able to detect when an account looks like a mule account that is suddenly receiving these new payments. Why should a consumer's account at a receiving institution suddenly be getting in a $1 million wire payment or a large ACH credit payment, right? There's something that is not logical about that type of fact pattern. So at the end of the day, this is an effort to improve the ability to identify and detect and recover, not saying it's going to be 100% foolproof, right? So that's really the intent and the perspective of our effort here in these rule changes.
Makes a lot of sense.
Mike, now that the rules have passed, what will NACHA be doing to ensure ACH network participants are informed and, you know, that they're ready for when the rules become effective?
Yeah, well, education is critical, and we have a full court kind of press or campaign in the works. The information about the rules is already available on NACHA's website. We've kind of blasted the world with emails and information. We'll have some additional user resources ready by the time of our annual payments conference that takes place in May. We're doing interviews like this one to try to help get the word out. And, you know, NACHA has also shifted our posture towards making available information to the end user community to kind of a, first of all, a free, model of hosting webinars, providing fact sheets at no cost to the end users. And we have upcoming webinars scheduled on these rule changes. We have a sign up on NACHA's website where anyone can sign up to get included on our listserv for rules information, whether they're a member or not, and, you know, at no cost to them. So really, you know, trying to do everything we can to get the word out about these rule changes, because they're very broad-based, and they're going to have a lot of parties out there that will have to, at a minimum, look at their own internal practices and policies and validate that they're doing what they should or that they need to improve. And you know, kind of making that initial assessment, that kind of thing should be happening fairly quickly across the industry.
Yeah, I would imagine when you look at the vulnerability on this too, when I look at myself versus my millennial children as an example, I haven't seen a paycheck in 35 years at least.
Right, a paper paycheck, right. Uh-huh.
It's all been direct deposit, and that's yep. The way I want it to. And I've had my same bank that I've used literally for the same period of time. But then I look at my millennial kids, and they go from fintech to bank, moving their bank account, the destination account,
right,
more times in a year than I have in my life.
Right.
So I would imagine that this has different vulnerabilities within age cohorts. And also, so I'm getting to the point of, what's the responsibility on the consumer side of this? Is no action required? Is it
we could probably have a whole other dialogue and conversation about the millennial cohort or younger people and how they utilize payments and services and apps and all that. I mean, at the end of the day, look, consumers will always have their rights that are encoded in Regulation E to have protection from unauthorized transactions out of their accounts. But I would also say that, you know, just like a payroll department or a treasury group, you know, consumers also need to be very cautious and verify who they're sending money to, right? Just because you can, you should know what you're doing, right? Who is the recipient that you're really sending the money to? I know that the institutions that I bank with have gotten very good about multiple reminders saying only send the money to people you know and trust, right? So I think there is some obligation on consumers to only send money to people you know and trust, particularly when you're using those types of apps, right, that allow you to do things like that. I think when you're talking about getting in a, you know, a payroll direct deposit, everyone should have zero trust about emails and texts about getting spoofed, and you need to give us your information so we can protect you or enter your credentials into this website so we can validate you. I mean, everyone should have zero trust about that kind of thing to try to prevent their payroll direct deposits or anything else from getting hacked and redirected in the first place.
Makes a lot of sense. I think we might need to invite you to my Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, you know, I'm the life of the party at my family conversations about these types of things and how to protect yourself. And, you know, I have my own kids in that cohort you're talking about, and also aging parents. And so I have the full age range of people to try to educate and keep safe.
Makes sense.
Thank you both so much for sharing your insights and perspective, and thanks to everyone for tuning in today. Be sure to subscribe and stay updated on the latest Payments Journal episodes, and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues.